It's Friday, April 13th. I'm Michelle Martin. From NPR News, it's Tell Me More. It's official. Radio host Don Imus has lost his job. But why him? Why now?
The wrong guy said the wrong thing about the wrong subject at the wrong time.
I've often found that his job was to be the cranky white man appealing to a certain demographic. And he was coarse, and he's been homophobic and sexist for years. But that was his job.
Imus fans and his critics talk about what it all means. Plus, a baseball widow decides she's tired of being left out.
I did not grow up playing sports. We didn't talk about sports in my house.
One woman's campaign to convert from baseball ignorance to bliss. And Apple TV. Apple's trying to do for video what they've already done for music. It's the next big thing. But first, let's hear the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As you know by now, Don Imus has been fired from his radio program for his comments about the Rutgers women's basketball team. Over the course of this week's controversy, we've heard a lot of criticism of Imus from African Americans, from the Reverend Al Sharpton to Whoopi Goldberg to former NAACP head Bruce Gordon. And for the most part, Imus's defenders have been white men, the same group that has made up the bulk of the listeners to Imus's program, and the guests for that matter, including many high-profile journalists and politicians. But something tells us the situation is a bit more complicated than just the white guys versus the black girls. So we put out a call on our blog asking people who listen to Imus to come onto the program and talk about why they listened and whether they think he crossed the line. And where indeed is that line for a so-called shock jock? Two of the people who responded have agreed to join us. We talked with them just after the news broke that Imus had been fired. In the Washington studio, Steve Peterson, a regular reader of our blog and website and an occasional Imus listener. Also with us, Anthony Diagnan Cabrera. He's an Imus listener who joined us from our New York bureau. He's also the editorial director of Imaginova Corporation, which publishes Space.com, among other websites. And we were also joined by a talk show industry expert, Michael Harrison. He's the editor and publisher of Talkers Magazine, and he joined us from his office in Springfield, Massachusetts. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Michael, I know you have only a short time with us here, so we'd like to start with you. You know that Mr. Imus has been fired. Do you think that was warranted?
Well, CBS has the right to do what they want. It's their First Amendment right, and they're running a business. So obviously, I don't think it was warranted at first. But if, in fact, all their sponsors are leaving, then I don't blame them for firing him because he's no longer of any value to them. But I think that Imus is the poster boy or the sacrifice, if you will, for many, many, many problems and circumstances that are unfolding before us of a historic proportion. And I think as a result, he's playing a role in history he never thought would happen to him.
Well, this isn't the first time that a shock jock episode has resulted in somebody being fired. I mean, like the host duo Opie and Anthony, for example, heavily criticized over the years. They've lost jobs for involvement in various stunts, like encouraging women to show their breasts in public, for example, right? Mm. I mean, we know that Don Imus has been saying things that a lot of people have found offensive over many, many years. So what's the line? What is it about this episode that you think
there's no line?
Brought
it has nothing to do with that. It has nothing with the line.
Conclusion.
It has to do with a moment. It has to do with what's going on at the moment. The line changes from minute to minute, and it changes from person to person. And ultimately, nobody, not me, not anyone, could, you know, scientifically or quantify exactly where the line is and why this is happening, other than to say there's a lot of things at work here. It's a perfect storm. And the wrong guy said the wrong thing about the wrong subject at the wrong time. The moon and the stars were lined up. And among the things that were going on is in the African-American community, and this is my read on it, there has been a growing frustration and unhappiness with the way certain words are used in public, the way certain stereotypical descriptives have been used to describe African Americans. There has been a growing frustration, resentment, and disgust with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it reached the tipping point when Imus uttered his words. Concurrently, there's another growing disgust happening, and that is the growing disgust that a lot of people in this country have with just the concept of shock jocks, of coarsening of America, of in-your-face media, of contentiousness to describe complex situations that should be done in a civilized way. And Imus has also suddenly become the poster boy for that.
Anthony, what did you want to say
about
this? Well,
I guess the issue is, you know, yeah, I agree. Yes, he's been dragged out as the poster boy. He crossed the line one too many times, and now he's been sacrificed. But I think we need to stop and look at this in the larger picture. Yes, you're right. The black community is upset about its own portrayal. But when someone even within the black community, like a Bill Cosby, goes out there to say, hey, we have to look in the mirror before we start throwing stones, there's a certain kind of double standard going on here. And this is the big problem. Imus, you listened to because you knew people that you liked were going to be on it, and you knew they might say something like announce they were going to go and run for office or retire from something. I've often found that his job was to be the cranky white man appealing to a certain demographic. And he was coarse, and he's been homophobic and sexist for years. But that was his job. If Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson really wanted to stop this, the sexism and the racism, they would go to Interscope and CBS and all the record labels that put out the rap artists who say the exact same thing.
You don't think
to stop
they have?
Because
Al Sharpton has. So you don't think it's fair. You don't think he should have been fired.
I think he should have been fired, but I think it's basically they're just picking on one person to make an example.
But why do you think he should have been fired then?
Because what he said was offensive, and he was offensive not only to the girls' big moment. It was a wonderful thing that happened to them, and they didn't make it, but still they showed great courage and performance, and they got so far, and he took that moment away from them, and that's the heartbreaking aspect for it. And it was kind of like shooting someone while they're down.
Well, let's bring Steve in here. Steve, you said you're an occasional Imus listener. When you do listen to him, why did you listen?
Well, I think I've mainly listened to him as I've been going through channel surfing, but the thing that kind of confuses me about this is I'm trying to figure out why all the moon and the stars aligned and everything coalesced on him now, because as we've established, he's done this for years. We've also established that people throughout culture do this. And I think a point is this is not about political correctness. This is about responsibility. And what Imus did was unresponsible. But the thing is he's been spewing this garbage about everyone.
But do you think he should have been fired?
Yeah, and in a way, I don't think this hasn't been overblown, but I think it's overdue. Because as a culture, we reward people like Don Imus for saying things like this to catch our attention. Not only do we listen to them, but our elite in the media and in politics and sports will go on his show and announce things and dignify him by having their clout on his show.
Michael Harrison, I wanted to ask you, what do you think has accounted for Don Imus's popularity all these years and his staying power?
He's an effective radio personality. There's something charismatic about the combination of his voice, his look, his irreverence, his intellect, his unpredictability.
Is part of the appeal the idea that he might just say anything?
Well, of course, that is the appeal. Why is it more interesting to hear John McCain announcing he's going to run for president on Imus than it is on 60 Minutes? On 60 Minutes, it's all planned, it's all polite, it's all a certain level of plastic superficiality. On Imus, he might say something about the political process or the circumstances of the candidate's announcement that everybody's thinking, but nobody would say on network television or in the New York Times. And that's what gives it its appeal.
Why do you think he said what he said?
I believe he said what he said because it was an attempt at being hip. He was trying to emulate a black man talking. White people in popular culture look to black culture to get their cue as to what's going to be hip next. Imus is a radio personality. Radio personalities are the hippest, streetiest people there are in the mass media. This is a tradition. So you take these two traditions, and here you have a 66-year-old man who was simply trying to be hip. He wasn't trying to denigrate anybody specifically, because that's what he does and that's what he's paid for to do.
Let's just all agree. There's a portion of the black community that uses this kind of language. The vast majority does not. I mean, would he condone shooting somebody because a tiny fraction of the black community engages in drive-by shootings, right? So if it's behavior that's not right, why is it okay for him to do it? You see my point?
I don't see your point.
No.
It's not that clear cut because hip conversation and the meaning of words is not the same as shooting somebody.
But so what? If the majority of the community doesn't like it and you have a number of people in the community who've spoken out against it.
But we don't know that. He doesn't know that they don't like it. He thinks it's okay. If anything, somewhere in his brain, he might have thought that that would make him more acceptable to black people.
Michael Harrison, why do you think it is to this point most of the people who've been defending him, as I see it, are white men?
I don't know whether that has any bearing here.
But why wouldn't
most
it?
Of the people defending him are white men. Most of the people that you hear talking in the media are white men. So, it's just a matter of numbers. I don't know if that's a statistical fact.
People have been defending him for years, but they've also been defending what a lot of other people say. Like Rush Limbaugh in January referred to Barack Obama as a African American. You know what? That's not funny. He's also said homophobic, awful things.
You raise an interesting point. What do you think that
means? I think
the
issue is that the black community and certain black leaders are able to mobilize faster by pulling around issues like race. And this is what they did. They said, guess what? We are going to make an example out of somebody. And we did, and they did it effectively. But ultimately, it was what really pushed it was people don't like losing money. And until the Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jackson of the world really put the pressure on the record labels to say, you know what? DMX's album is full of really awful language about women and about, you know, gay people. You got to stop that. And but they're not.
Sales of records have declined precipitously over the
last
year.
Well, they're declining because the demographics are changing. People get older, and the next big thing is coming in the pop music scene.
Well, how do you know that's what it is and not that people are disgusted by it and that they're voting with their pocketbooks?
Because music, that's how music has always changed through the years. It's cyclical.
I'd like to hear some closing thoughts from each of you. And I guess, Michael, I'd like to start with you. Do you think that the shock jock genre will change because of this?
I don't even think there is a shock jock genre. I don't think there's anything shocking about anything you hear on the radio. I think what they do on Grey's Anatomy and Boston Legal is far more shocking than anything Ima says. And you see on basic network primetime shows racial stereotypes about black people, about Jews, about women, about gays, that if it had come out of Ima's mouth, you'd say, oh, shock jock. So I can't say how the shock jock genre is going to change because as the publisher of the leading trade in that industry, I'm telling you, it doesn't exist. There just are different kinds of radio personalities, some of whom are mouthier than others.
So you don't think that the culture of talk radio will be affected by this?
I think the culture of the whole country will be affected by it because I said we have a sea change coming in which the nation as a whole has reached a point where there is a critical mass of resentment against this type of language and this type of discourse.
Okay.
And that's what Ima's is being sacrificed so that we can enter a new era in the media, in our cultures, and in our conversations. This is a problem that we all face. If we're going to turn it into white versus black, and we're going to turn it into the world versus Ima's, the problem is not going to be solved.
Coming up, we have a couple more minutes with Michael Harrison of Talkers Magazine and two Ima's fans, and later we'll talk with two Ima's critics who say the problem doesn't stop with him. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll hear from a panel of African-American women and get their take on the firing of Don Imus and its ramifications. But first, we conclude our conversation with a radio talk show specialist and two Don Imus listeners. We had comments from Anthony Dignan Cabrera, an occasional Don Imus listener.
Radio shows and a lot of popular culture now is not about dialogue. It's about big personalities giving you their opinion, and you're supposed to take
exactly.
it and pandering to people's own insecurities and biases and prejudices.
Bingo.
And that's how it's being marketed. They're making money on people's inbuilt prejudices and biases. That's why the Rush Limbaugh survived. That's why Don Imus went on for so long. Now, you're right. When I first read what he said, it hurt me personally because I felt bad for those girls. And then when I saw the girls addressing the issue a couple of days ago on television, it really hurt me because I said, these are great women. And they've had this big moment, and they're somebody's daughter, and those things hurt. It does. Anyone with a sense of, you know, decency would understand that it would hurt you personally because it's part of the greater culture
well,
of
not,
who we
not,
are.
Not necessarily. Some people feel that it's just a joke, and he's an equal opportunity offender, and that people should just toughen up. I mean, I can tell you that we got a lot of responses on our blog in both directions. We had a number of people saying, self-identifying, I'm a white male, but I'm also a father, and I didn't appreciate these young women being spoken of in this way. And we also had other people to say, look, you know what, it's a joke. If you don't like it, don't listen. So, I don't know. Steve, you wanted to get into this
conversation. Well, Michelle, like, the thing that bothers me is it's so casual. And as a society, we accept that it's all right for... We almost live vicariously through people, either through our insecurities, or these people say things that either we would like to say or things that we wish we could get away with saying. And we're not going to stand up for this as the lady basketball players have. We're going to continue to have people like Imus spew about you name it, and everyone is going to be offended, and people are going to be attacking people. And while we do need to develop thick skins and not necessarily read beyond the line or try to always look for ways to take offense, we also don't need to encourage that. And I also have a problem with the media. Should companies sit there and go, okay, this is what our audiences want? Is that what we should give them? And that's a tough thing.
Well, let's, because we actually promised Michael we would let him go a lot longer.
Yeah, I have to run, but can I just say before I go?
Sure.
This company that presented this and would have continued to present it had sponsors not pulled out suddenly has a revelation from God that this is a bad thing, and they fire him. And then on their other network, the NBC Nightly News, on a day that Americans are dying in Iraq, they lead off and spend half of their half-hour newscast covering the story. So the point I'm making is, before you go and buy this, and I accept this as just being simplistic and one-dimensional, it is so complex, and there is so much fraud going on in terms of hypocrisy and obscuring the truth. And that's the real problem. And I have to run. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. And Anthony?
No, I mean, it's right. It is a sickness that the media world is so consumed by ratings and giving the people what they want and lowest common denominator.
Okay, but you're a publisher of content, right? You're a content provider. So
yes. It's very difficult. You know what they'll eat and you know what they should have. And there's a fine line. But with the big networks, the giant networks who are making billions of dollars, they would continue to have anyone on the air. The only reason why they fired this guy was that the advertisers finally caved in.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Anthony Dignan Cabrera is an occasional Imus listener who joined us from our New York bureau. He's also the editorial director of Imaginova Corporation. And thank you, Anthony, so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Steve Peterson joined us here in our Washington studio, and he responded to our call for Imus listeners to join us on this program. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We were also joined by Michael Harrison. He's the editor and publisher of Talkers Magazine. He joined us from his office in Springfield, Massachusetts. So as you know, we've been speaking with fans of Imus's show and a talk radio industry insider. But now we want to turn to other voices, the voices of some African-American women who have been writing and thinking about all of this. And I'm joined by Rose Scott, a freelance sports writer and sports talk show host. Teresa Welts, a writer for the Style section of the Washington Post, where she writes about arts and the popular culture, and E.R. Shipp, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalism professor. Welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Rose, I want to start with you. You know, you heard the previous discussion, and you heard some talk about the fact that the terms that got Imus in so much trouble are terms that have gained some popular currency. And you wrote about this on your blog, in your blog posting April 9th. You wrote, "Where do you think Don Imus received the unceremonious nod to degrade black women in free speech? It comes right from my own community." So do you think that, as some of our previous guests believe, that the, so, I don't know what you want to call it, urban black culture bears some responsibility for making this okay?
I think that there is an accountability there. Now, let me back up here for a minute, too, because I also think it's important to understand that while these terms are used primarily through the hip-hop and rap, and even just on a daily basis in the streets, regardless of what color the neighborhood is, it doesn't make it right. And for Don Imus to use it as an excuse was also just as lame. Now, just because you hear this in rap music or hip-hop or whatever, why would you want to continue the degradation of a community, of a specific group of people? And then you use that, you target a specific group of people, the Rutgers women's basketball team. That doesn't make it right.
Understood. But do you think that, as you wrote in your blog, that maybe the black community needs to do some thinking about this?
Right. And you know, we have. There have been, this goes way back to C. Dolores Tucker, who decades ago tried to stop this. Now, I'm not for censorship, but I am for people really taking a look at what is creative art and what goes into that process. You know, hip-hop has come a long way. So is it still necessary to continue to use lyrics that degrade black women? I don't want to hear about, well, you know, this is a part of our society. It's not a part of my society. It's not a part of my hood, because my father never referred to my mother other than Alice or honey, and my brothers never used that terminology toward me or the women they dated. And if it was known to my father or other men in my family, there would have been some issues.
Teresa Welts, what do you think? You write about hip hop among many other topics. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that it's so easy to, you know, paint this broad brush that hip hop in general. And there's a lot of very interesting progressive rap out there that where women are not hoes and the B word or. But that's not what we hear on the radio and in pop culture. I mean, that's not what is bought. I think we also need to remember that the majority of consumers of hip-hop, it's 80% are white males, I believe, are the statistics. I might be wrong about that. But it's a huge, huge portion of the hip-hop audience is white. And also I agree with Rose. I mean, I just bristle at the notion that this is how black people talk, you know, as if we're just this one big monolithic pathology. I mean, I never heard that in my house growing up. My husband does not call me a hoe. I don't call myself a hoe. My father didn't call my mother a hoe. It's, you know, it's not a part of, you know, my culture and my language. And so I bristle at this notion that that's what we do. And
okay, but what about these popular culture, you know, these shows like Flavor of Love, where this former rap star, Flavor Flav, is mm-hmm. having this contest to, I don't know what it is, he's having it to pick a love interest. And these women compete in a really aggressive, sexualized, you know, fashion. I mean, we don't need to go into all the details mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think people need to hear that. You've written about the show. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the majority of viewers, as you've written, are African-American women. What do you say?
You know, it's interesting. I had some very complicated feelings about Flavor of Love because when I first heard about it, I was just beyond outraged because the women do indeed make a fool of themselves. But also, I it's farce. I mean, it's so over the top. It's so ridiculous that it's hard to take it seriously.
But that's what Don Imus said he's doing. He said he's making a joke.
I know, but there's a different dynamic, and I'm not excusing.
What is the different dynamic?
I think the dynamic is, and I'm not excusing Flavor of Love. I mean, I have issues with it. So I want to be clear about that. I think the different dynamic is that you have this old white man who's in a position of power, who has presidential candidates on his show, who, you know, it's straddling the line between being a shock jock and being, you know, a journalist. Calling young women who are not public figures a hoe. I mean, I just, it's the viciousness of it, the specificity of it, and the viciousness of it just kind of took my breath away.
And as I heard you say, the power difference between
yes.
this very visible,
yes.
you know, senior media figure, establishment media figure, sort of, more or less, and these young women. ER, what do you think about all this?
Well, there are a number of ways one can look at this. For one thing, when you're talking about flavor of love and such situations, we have to understand that there is going to be a whole range of entertainments or even media outlets out there, and that we may get a flavor of love on one side, speaking again from a black perspective, but we'll get more intelligent thought with a Tavis Smiley, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So we have to expect that and cannot allow ourselves to be defined by flavor of love. With the why did people go so crazy over Imus this time, I think people have touched on it, but I've never listened to Imus, by the way, because I made that choice that I don't need shock jocks in my life. There's too much in the real world to be shocked about and to do something about than to be looking at people beating up on people for entertainment purposes, which is what Imus has done. So we can always switch the dial. Having said that, when we learn that something as outrageous as this has occurred, that Imus, in the position he has gone after young women who have worked hard to overcome all kinds of odds to become almost the national champions in women's basketball. They are outstanding students, outstanding leaders on their campus. He doesn't know them, and he just automatically sees black women, strong black women, and out of his mouth comes this phrase. He needs to be talked to about that, but it's an opportunity to educate America. What is it about this? Is the combination of nappy-headed and ho, or is it something else? But I think we use this as an opportunity not just to keep beating up on Imus, because he's going away, but where do we take this conversation is what we ought to be focusing on.
Rose, you had a live radio show. Do you mm-hmm. is that part of the game to go as far as you can? I mean, and look at, you know, your blog. You advertise it as a no holds barred blog.
You know,
of sports and society. And I'm not saying, you know, you're going out trashing people, because I've never seen any evidence of that. But isn't that part of the game?
Well, unfortunately, it is. When I started out in sports talk, and I had a very successful sports talk show here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I never had to use, you know, references to belittle or dog somebody. If a player was not, you know, playing up to par, I would say, oh, you know what, this guy needs to step it up or whatever. I didn't have to do that. I mixed, because my approach to doing sports was that, you know what, not only I know that I'm going to attract more women and even and young kids, so my approach was not to be shocking and to spew all kinds of hatred and sexist comments, because that doesn't work for me. I know that a lot of colleagues in this industry, they do it. But being a black woman, there's no way in the world that I could use the privilege that I had with the microphone to talk about a subject that I love, which is sports and society, and then take that opportunity and spend half the time, you know, spewing hatred or racist or sexist remarks, even with issues that had everybody just on fire, whether it was the Kobe Bryant incident or Mike Tyson or whatever. I still approach my job with professionalism, and even if I disagree with a caller or a guest, and there were many times I had Terrell Owens on my show for 2 hours.
But you know mm-hmm. what? You're focusing on grown-ups, so to speak, professionals. And I think that also is what struck people in this particular episode, that, okay, it's one thing to say something about a professional football player or basketball player. We may object to it. Or to say something about a politician. We may object to it. But he reached way down to pick mm-hmm. on amateurs, mm-hmm. college students, teenagers, who mm-hmm. had done nothing bad.
Nothing bad. They were not some sort of high-profile multimillionaire.
He specifically targeted a group of women.
You know what I wanted to ask, though, and Teresa, maybe you can help us with this. In the days leading up to this, I was reading a lot of the things that people were writing, you know, including, you know, Rose, Jill Nelson, a number of other writers. Many of them were very skeptical that any consequences would actually be felt. Well, now they have been felt. Do you think that this signals some change in the culture about whether these kinds of comments are acceptable? And I wonder if particularly in the hip-hop community, which is being discussed as part of the origin of this kind of dialogue. What do you think?
Well, a couple of things. The cynic in me was just waiting for Don Imus to check himself into rehab as part of his apology tour. So
he sort of did that with meeting with the students last night, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. And apparently he is, I'm not sure if this is true, but he is an AA person, I believe.
Well, I don't want to assess his motives, and if he were an AA, that would be a private matter, so I don't want to attack his motives. But tell me what you think about whether this signals about the rest of us and the way this kind of thing will be discussed.
Honestly, the cynic in me just thinks that this is about money. I'm not so sure that this is signaling, you know, a sea change in our culture as much as it is. It got a little too hot, and without financial backing, that's it. He's a financial liability, and so he's out the door.
Okay, Chip. Chip, we're down our last couple of minutes, literally a minute, Chip. So what do you think? Change in the culture? Just a momentary pause?
I think it may be the beginning of a change in culture if those who led this particular battle keep the pressure on and the others in the society join in keeping the pressure on. What was very impressive to me was that a number of the executives who've come out to explain why they are cutting their ties to Imus mentioned the fact that they are fathers, they have daughters. They're beginning to understand what young women have to go through in this society, and they've also become a little bit more sensitive to what young black women have to go through. So if we keep that in mind, I think we can build upon that movement.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. I think I will be reading what you all write about this, and maybe we'll come back again in a year, maybe, or a couple months, and see whether things have changed. Well, let's see. Thanks so much for joining us. Rose Scott, a freelance sports writer and sports talk show host. She joined us from member station WABE in Atlanta. Teresa Wilds is a writer for the Washington Post Style section. And E.R. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and they joined us on the phone. Thank you, ladies, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the next big thing, a household appliance or a revolution?
It is brain dead simple. For anybody who's put their cable outlet in the back of their television, it's essentially that simple.
Stay with us. The next big thing, just ahead. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More.
Support for NPR comes from Miller Brewing Company, whose Respect 21 efforts encourage adults to unite and not supply alcohol to teens. Underage drinking, it's not inevitable, it's preventable. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home to 18,000 new jobs last year, at e-country.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Vietnamese government jails one of its most prominent critics.
He has acted nonviolently. He has not hurt anyone. People out here, we live in such a beautiful democracy system. We cannot just turn a blind eye to these type of injustices that are happening.
Now, some Vietnamese Americans and a U.S. congresswoman want the U.S. government to help seek his release. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News. Thank you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we'll find out how one intrepid baseball widow learned to love the game, or at least tolerate it. But first, it's time for our weekly feature, The Next Big Thing, a regular look at all that is hip, happening, and on the edge. Even if you're a techno troglodyte like me, you've probably heard about on-demand TV and movies. You can get those through your cable company. But a new product is trying to do for television what the iPod has done for music downloading. It's called Apple TV. It's our next big thing for this week. Here to tell us all about it is Alan Weiner. He works for Gartner Incorporated, an independent research group, and he recently took Apple TV on a test drive. He joins us from Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So do I have that right, that Apple TV is essentially an MP3 player or an iPod for movies?
It's the Trojan horse, actually. A lot of people are looking at the Apple TV as an extension of their current ecosystem for entertainment in the home, but it goes far beyond that if you kind of visualize where it's headed.
How exactly does this work? Is it essentially a computer console? Is it like a cable box that you hook up to your TV?
The best way of thinking about it is it's kind of the next generation set-top box. Now, it's not geared to receive live television signals, but it's geared essentially to help you aggregate and distribute on-demand television programs or video that's distributed through your iTunes software.
So it all comes from iTunes?
Correct.
Nowhere else?
There's a trick question there. If you are, say, a consumer creator, or you create your own video, for example, you actually can import that into iTunes quite simply, as I've done and watched my own video creations on my big screen at home.
Why do you want to do that? You already created them on your desktop, right? Why do you want to put it through another device to watch it on your TV?
I guess it would be analogous to watching your old home movies in the old days, your Super 8, you know, videos in a bigger and more comfortable setting. So anybody who can create content in the format that's recognized by iTunes can upload content into iTunes.
You referred to the Apple TV as a Trojan horse. Why do you use that term?
A Trojan horse is a product that gets into your life for one purpose. The iPod is a good example. I mean, the iPod was intended originally for you to burn your music as well as to put songs from iTunes on it. But over time, they began to do other things like offer podcasts. So it's a product that extends into other applications beyond its original intention.
Is there anything else like this out there?
Well, there are a couple of competitors in the market. One would be what Microsoft is doing through its Xbox game console, which is quite clever, and it's actually even the ultimate Trojan horse. So Microsoft came out with a variation of its Xbox gaming platform called Xbox Live and created the Xbox Live video marketplace. You can purchase television programs, you can purchase movies. And actually, the significant difference is that the movies are mostly in high definition.
So getting back to Apple TV, the chief difference between Apple TV and the Microsoft system that you were telling us about is that Microsoft has more accessibility to all these other different kinds of content, whereas Apple right now is pretty much focused on iTunes and the stuff that you create yourself and content that they're making available on iTunes. Is that right?
That's correct. Now, keep in mind, I mean, iTunes has a vast array of content, so you could actually download an MGM movie, say Rocky, and you can download it to your iTunes, which gives you the flexibility of watching it on three screens. You can watch it right there on your PC. You can sync it with your iPod, or you could sync it with your Apple TV and watch it there. So the goal is total portability.
Or to make yourself crazy. Because I really can't understand why I want to watch the same movie on three screens. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Okay, so it's like you start the movie at home, and then you get into your car, and you get to Uncle Bob's house, and then you finish watching it there without losing a beat. Is that it?
Right, but you're intuitively asking a very interesting question, which I've been wrestling with. And that is, how many more channels do we need to distribute the same content? I'm quite comfortable watching My Name is Earl on Thursday night or time shifted on my plasma TV. Do I truly need it, you know, in so many other venues? I think you begin to see a whole new range of content companies begin to make content expressly for this viewing venue. And I think that that's where it begins to get interesting, and we're seeing that happen today in the marketplace.
I'm wondering what effect that has on the entertainment industry. Does it just kind of further fragment? Because I'm just wondering how all those eyeballs find all that content, or how all that content finds the eyeballs it's supposed to find.
The issue that you're raising is one that, you know, we look at quite carefully. I call it, you know, timeshare and wallet share shift. So people who started watching television to a regular fashion and then began to watch it through their TiVos or time shifted, created a different viewing pattern that obviously has an impact on advertising, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as people begin to watch content through their Apple TV or through their iPod or through their Xbox, and the audience for traditional viewing begins to shift even slightly, that sends alarm bells through the advertising world, because then the advertisers are going to need to find these people where they live, even if it's in new places, and figure out how to reach them.
Is there anything you don't like about it?
I want more programming, and I also want high-definition content. I'm watching, you know, this content on a high-definition television, and I think pretty quickly the content creators are going to recognize that and begin to create content.
What do you like most about Apple TV?
It is brain dead simple. For anybody who's even hooked up the simplest stereo system, or somebody who's put their cable outlet in the back of their television, it's essentially that simple.
Okay.
And the New York Times has an active and exciting video channel that they've created. And I'm watching this new, interesting content that I've never seen before. So what the Apple TV does is it gives a whole new array of content companies, newspapers, magazines, comedy clubs, you name it. This gives them that seamless channel to be able to reach people.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Alan Weiner works for Gartner Incorporated, an independent research group, and he joined us from Phoenix, Arizona. If you're a baseball fan, I don't have to tell you, April brings nirvana. Another chance to hit the bleachers, obsess over the stats, the history, the ups, the downs, the in-betweens of your favorite major league team. But what if you are not a fan? What if you really don't care? Worse, what if you really don't care and you're married to one of those baseball obsessives? What if you're a baseball widow? Well, at the start of the Nationals' current season, we learned one baseball widow's strategy for coping. Sydney Trent is the deputy editor of the Washington Post Sunday magazine, and she wrote the April 1st cover story, The Gal of Summer. Sydney Trent joins us from the office of the Washington Post. Sydney, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, you took the radical step of trying to become a fan.
Now I did.
Now, I have to point out that this wasn't one of those fake first date moves where you pretended to like it. You were already married for a very long time, and after years of tolerating this obsession, you actually decided to make a project of becoming a fan. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, basically, I didn't come up with it. Actually, if I were going to come up with it naturally, I would have done it, you know, 20 years ago when I started dating my husband. This is the first season of the Nationals, and everybody is kind of very into it. I guess it's before it started to go sour at the end. And I was just kind of ranting about why it is that people get so into sports and practically throw themselves off a cliff. And so, you know, I was telling, you know, my boss this, and he said, you know, that's a great story idea. You should try to make yourself a fan over the course of a season. I didn't really
leap at the prospect.
Well, yeah, I was skeptical about my ability to do it because I thought, well, shoot, you know, if I were able to do this, wouldn't I have done it a long time ago? But at the same time, I was curious about how people reach that state and, you know, what it would be like to experience it.
Well, what was your baseline, though? Did you have no interest in sports at all? I mean, was there any other experience that you could readily translate, or you just were just not feeling
it? I did not grow up playing sports. We didn't talk about sports in my house. And, you know, and I guess I thought, well, you know, it's very into presidential politics during the last election. I mean, weren't we all? And so I was thinking, you know, maybe it's similar to that. It's like an affiliation that is stamped on you in childhood, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat. And that's where all of that passion comes from. So that was probably my closest parallel, is getting into political races.
What did you do to get immersed in the life of the baseball fan?
We decided that I was going to be somebody the reader could relate to. So I wasn't going to take advantage of my ability to interview people at the Nationals or, you know, to do a lot of, you know, research. So I mainly just relied on the Post, the sports pages, and people I knew who were into baseball. And then, you know, I would go to games occasionally. And I tried to listen on the radio, and I think I'll be doing more of that this season.
But you also went to spring training.
I went to spring training, and that's great because it's so beautiful. It's just so relaxed, and you're very kind of up close and personal watching the players.
Did you get autographs?
I did. I sure did. I got Jose Vidro to give me an autograph, and I immediately, you know, felt this kind of surge of thinking he was a good guy and maybe I would pay attention to him, maybe realize how that kind of personal contact with a player can make a difference.
Was it helpful to find somebody to root for?
You know, for me, that made all the difference. I have to tell you, I really wound up rooting for Alfonso Soriano because he turned out to be, you know, not only a great player, you know, kind of a charismatic, flashy player, but also seemed to me to be a pretty decent guy. And for me, I know it's cliche because they say this is true of women when it comes to hooking into sports, being able to kind of humanize one of the players and kind of get an attachment to a person out there was important because it was a pretty lousy season. You know, if it weren't for that, I don't think there would have been any hope for me.
So how did it end up for you? Could you call yourself a fan?
You know, I guess it depends on what level of fandom. I was not going to, by the end of the season, I wasn't going to be throwing myself on, you know, the floor when they lost and, you know, crying or getting upset, or kind of like, you know, my husband was pretty upset when the Phillies almost became the wild card team and then they didn't. He was worked up about it, and you know, I watched him and I thought, I'm not a fan like that.
Well, what did you learn over the course of the season? Did you figure out what it is that makes people care so much about these teams?
I learned that, you know, it's a lot easier to care if you pay attention and become knowledgeable. Just kind of the beauty of focusing on something helps you to care. And I had never really focused before. And I learned a tremendous amount. It's like a drop in the bucket compared to, say, what my husband knows about baseball. But it's much, much more than I ever knew. After so many years, it just kind of helped me understand what a part of his childhood and his relationship with his dad and his brother baseball was. I never really thought about that before. And I just think that's true. I think people have memories of growing up, and it just becomes part of the fabric of your life and who you are.
So how are your Nats doing so far?
Oh, God, it's painful. It's really awful. I don't know. You know, and I'm thinking, boy, we have these tickets. I guess we got to use them.
So what's going on? They dropped the opener. And then what happened?
Yeah, they've just, you know, people are talking about them being, you know, historically bad, you know, record losses this season. But, you know, the thing to remember is that this is really a calculation on the ownership's part, that they're going to not spend money on them in the short term. And after, when the stadium opens next year, they're really going to start infusing the team with cash. And so you can't really look at it and get too demoralized because, you know, really there is next season to look forward to. So,
Sydney,
you know, we'll just sleepwalk through this.
Sydney, you sound like a fan. Sydney Trent.
I am, kind of. I am. Okay. I said it. I am.
Sydney Trent is deputy editor of the Washington Post Sunday magazine. She joined us to talk about her April 1st cover story, The Gal of Summer. You can read it on our website. Sydney Trent, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Michelle.
And now that we've got you all set to shop for your Apple TV and get out to the ballpark, we have one more nugget to take you to the weekend. Continuing with the baseball theme, it's time for our segment, In Your Ear. This is where we ask our guests who tell us what music they listen to. We recently caught up with a certain famous baseball player in our NPR West studios.
This is Dave Winfield, Hall of Fame baseball player. What I listen to most is probably smooth jazz. There was an old friend of mine, he passed away not quite 10 years ago. Milt Jackson played the vibes. He was a neighbor of mine, actually, in New Jersey when I played for the Yankees. There were a couple of friends back there, Dizzy Gillespie and folks like that. I don't get a chance to listen to the radio a great deal during the baseball season, but when I do and I'm traveling on the road, I just want to get the good vibe and feel good. It's not elevator music that I'm listening to. I liked his music from the beginning to the end. I would turn my lights out late at night and just let my mind drift with Milt Jackson. Rest his soul, he's looking down on us and listening, and with it, he got a smile on his face.
That was Baseball Hall of Famer Dave Winfield talking about the music of jazz vibraphonist Milt Jackson. We heard Stairway to Stairs and then Milt Jackson's rendition of the classic Round Midnight. If you want to tell us what you're listening to these days, let us know at npr.org/tellmemore. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Amy Alexander, Monica Evstatieva, Sue Goodwin, Rachel Guberman, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Wendy Johnson, Jennifer Longmire, A.C. Valdez, and Walter Watson. The show is directed by Rob Sachs. Our technical director is Ivan Burketh. The supervising senior producer is Marie Nelson. I'm Michelle Martin. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. From the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company, sponsor of 30 Days of Green, to help kids value green spaces, Scotts Miracle-Gro, dedicated to a beautiful world. And from Kay and Matthew Buxbaum for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.